Welcome to The Investment Conversation, Lord Abbott's ongoing podcast series.
This is Will Andrews. Joining me today is Lord Abbott investment strategist Tim Paulson, a specialist in fixed income. Tim, a forthcoming series of white papers on LordAbbott.com will offer some intriguing insights on how and where active management can add value in portfolios. We'll talk more about that, but it's almost obligatory for us to first address a broader active versus passive question. You have an interesting take on that.
Well, thanks, Will. And I guess first I just reframe that question of active versus passive, because I really don't think this is an active versus passive question, because they're frankly so very different. Both can have and do have important roles in a portfolio. They do very different things. They purport to add value in very different ways. And what we've found is that active tends to do best in areas where passive really kind of struggles. It's just the opportunity set tends to be very different.
So, And talking about the debate, what really kind of drives some of the hostility or the resistance to active management that we see in some research and in the financial media?
Well, this really goes back a couple of decades, and it started, as many things do, in academia. Really two core premises. One, that markets are fundamentally efficient so that any future price moves are driven by randomness. That in turn would suggest that luck, not skill, is the reason for any kind of outperformance. And is therefore not sustainable. The second is this idea of kind of a zero-sum game, that for every winner in the market, there has to be a loser. So if everyone out there is actively managing, then, you know, who are you if it's all luck-based and one person's going to be a winner, then another's going to be a loser? Those are really important concepts, and academic research has done a lot to just kind of make people more thoughtful about their approaches to active management. But it turns out that these concerns are not universal. And this is something that really a lot of more recent studies have helped highlight, that markets are not perfectly efficient, that this zero-sum argument only makes sense if everyone has the same investment goals. But there is room for both sides of a trade to be a winner.
So, but you're telling me that in a world of instantaneous news and light-speed trading, that markets can still be inefficient. It's almost hard to believe. You'd think Mr. Market would have everything figured out by now.
Well, eventually things do, but things don't correct in instantaneous time. And you can see examples of this all over the place. But generally, it breaks down to the idea that information is not disseminated in a perfectly even and efficient manner. And also, there are liquidity concerns and liquidity mechanisms. It may take some time before a market can correct to an appropriate level. Of course, there are a lot of distortive influences out there, but I'd say those are the two primary reasons that it can take a while.
I'd kind of like to dig a little bit deeper on this. What exactly drives this inefficiency? Tell us a bit about some of the factors that might be causing this.
Well, I mentioned liquidity, and this, of course, can be a very real concern. You know, we might, certainly many people on a day-to-day experience may decide, gee, I wish I could sell my car or my house. And it doesn't happen instantaneously. There's some period of transactional friction before that can get recognized. Of course, you see similar things in the securities markets. I might decide I want to buy a specific bond, but I can only buy it if there's a seller out there, a willing seller that I can instantly locate. This can take a while. There are some very distortive impacts on the marketplace. There are a lot of financial regulations. Mm-hmm. Banks may have completely different reasons for buying an asset that you as an investor might have when you're thinking only about your total return. Mm-hmm. Banks are more worried about regulatory considerations. We have central banks who will put trillions of dollars into the marketplace buying only certain assets. That's an inefficiency. They're not worried about the economics or the total return. They have completely different concerns that they're trying to achieve. And there's a host of these kinds of distortive influences in the marketplace. We can even talk about credit ratings, mm-hmm. where you have an artificial third-party tiering of risk. Mm-hmm. And yet there are certain investors who can only buy something if it has a certain investment grade. You've based on this tiering, cut off a certain amount of investment dollars from owning a certain asset. So these do exist. They're out there, and they permeate marketplaces. Some of these are structural. Some of these can be temporary.
So then tell us more about how this creates opportunities for active managers who recognize some of the mispricings that are caused by these inefficiencies.
Well, I think the key thing here, Will, is that in order for active management to succeed, you need two preconditions. You need the existence of an inefficiency in the marketplace, and then a manager also has to have skill in monetizing that inefficiency. too often managers will have skill, but maybe not focus in areas where there are actual inefficiencies. And, you know, there are a list of very liquid, transparent markets where it's incredibly difficult to generate outperformance, again, because these markets are not very inefficient. But this is, in a nutshell, how a manager achieves any kind of outperformance in active management is by focusing on areas that have inefficiencies and working hard to generate some kind of knowledge advantage or information advantage in that area. And that in turn can lead to the ability to monetize those.
I actually do want to talk about the luck versus skill issue. I think we can table that for a bit, because what I wanted to get to here was some more of the sort of the myths or the misunderstandings about active. For example, we always hear about how active's higher fees weigh on performance versus passive, but you have found that's a topic that needs a bit more exploration before you can make such statements.
Well, this in some ways leads to a broader point about some of these academic studies and some of the commonly perpetuated myths around active management. And that is that when you look back at these studies, you find they have to make a lot of assumptions. There's not a widespread prevalence of data upon which to draw. And so in general, studies around active management have to make assumptions about things as basic as a benchmark against which a strategy should be measured. Fees, because fees change over time. And very often the fees that are used in studies are from a higher fee era back in the 90s. And yet still kind of held in these studies. In general, lots of assumptions about performance and fees that may not really be appropriate when we consider conditions today, or at least may not tell us the whole story. Fees are an excellent example. As I said, many fees and, you know, many studies use fees from the 90s that aren't appropriate today when fees are much lower. What you'll also find is certain passive strategies may even have higher fees than comparable active strategies. Again, very surprising. When you look in extremely liquid markets, fees can be quite low in passive strategies. But when you look in some of the less liquid markets, you take something like the high yield market in the U.S., you know, even certain emerging markets, what have you, fees can actually be quite high and often exceed those in active strategies. So active strategies have certainly felt the pressure acutely in order to focus on fees. And that aspect of active management, at least, seems to have been very much addressed.
You had looked at a particular study from a well-known index provider showing that active strategies underperformed the benchmark Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate Index, or as we affectionately call it, the AG. What was the takeaway there? What did you notice about the actual benchmark itself?
Well, there are a few points here, Will. One is, you know, we do tend to make, and maybe this is just one reason that I'll say this isn't an active versus passive issue. All of these studies argue simply the merits of active management and whether active, the value add or the potential value add from active is enough to justify the fees. There's a completely separate issue around passive, because passive in some places can be implemented much more easily, maybe with higher, you know, with lower tracking error, what have you. But one fundamental issue is just simply the existence of benchmarks. You know, when you ask about inefficiencies in the market, the existence of benchmarks is a prime example. You talk about the Bloomberg Barclays AG. This is an index that's changed considerably over the last decade. The primary risk characteristic, duration or interest rate sensitivity, has gone up fully 50%. The composition of the index has changed. And yet this is still very often just something people passively put in their portfolios without considering how the risk profile has changed so much over the years.
Yeah, what's changed about the AG? The AG is really so important in the way that we measure, you know, fixed income performance. What's kind of, you know, altered it over the years?
Well, of course, this is one of the fundamental problems with any debt-based benchmark, that the more any entity borrows, the more passive investors will lend them. Of course, the big borrower over the last decade in the U.S. has been the U.S. government. So there is now a vast preponderance of the available debt, or certainly the change in debt out there is U.S. treasuries. That's one thing if you're getting very generously compensated for treasuries, but of course, yields are famously low, and investors in the AG own more and more of this treasury risk. But you can see this, you know, for example, look at an emerging market index, and Argentina comes to market with billions in new issue. Passive investors will just automatically lend Argentina more money, whether it's a good idea or not. Brazil comes to market with a 100-year bond. Again, passive investors just give them this money because That's the nature of a debt-based index. Mm-hmm. If it's out there, we lend.
Tim, it seems indexes have a way of changing their composition over time.
Yeah, well, Will, index construction or composition is a fundamental problem in markets for investors. This is one reason that there's been a rise in other quasi-passive strategies like smart beta. Some managers like us will go with more of a strategic benchmark approach. We believe there are better ways to construct benchmarks than to just say, this is generically what's out there, you're going to own this and arbitrarily not own this. You know, in the case of something like the Bloomberg Barclays Ag, there's a huge amount of treasury issuance over the last decade. So it was very surprising when I ran into this study from SPIVA that spanned multiple decades.
So by SPIVA, you mean the research unit of S&P Dow Jones Indices?
Yeah, that's exactly correct, Will. It's a very well-recognized and authoritative unit, certainly something we've encountered quite a bit. So it was very surprising when I ran into a study that claimed that only roughly a third of active strategies out there had managed to outperform the Bloomberg Barclays Ag. You know, again, not consistent with our own experience, yet typically held up as an example, you know, this kind of intermediate duration versus the ag is typically held up as an example of areas where active does outperform.
So, Tim, what was the time frame on that study?
This went back decades, Will.
Yeah.
And, you know, as with anything that spans decades, you have to kind of make some assumptions, and I'll go into that a bit because that's really kind of the key to this point I'd like to make, because just out of curiosity, we flipped the study on its head. So we pulled the same database from eVestment that SPIVA sourced and looked at the performance of the benchmark in the category too, not something people typically do. And much more consistent, actually even more so than we thought. How did the benchmark do in that category? Well, the benchmark was in the bottom 5% over the last decade. That seemed very, very inconsistent with the claim that only a third of the strategies, of the active strategies, are outperforming that benchmark. So, you know, I mentioned assumptions. Turns out those assumptions are not trivial details. In this particular case, the authors of the study were trying to deal with the idea of survivorship bias. You know, how do we not reward the winners? Well, in this case, they assumed that any closed strategy would become a bottom performer. That's a big assumption when you have hundreds of strategies that have closed over the years. And I've talked to some folks and they say, well, sure, if it closed, it must have been a terrible strategy. But in this case, more than 60% of the strategies had a 10-year track record of outperforming. So there are a whole lot of reasons for outperforming. It could be a merger with two managers. It could be economic considerations. Maybe they just hadn't raised enough scale assets. But there are a whole lot of reasons. And again, more than 60% of the strategies that they assumed were bottom performers had a 10-year track record of outperformance. And yet, the study claimed that only roughly a third of them outperformed. So again, these things can be very misleading. There's a lot that we take for granted when we talk about passive. I'm not trying to say active is better than passive or vice versa, but it's very much worth pausing and considering what these studies are telling us, because they're not giving us the full picture. You know, they can obscure the issue of what the real value add is. There's a gray spectrum versus black and white.
Thanks, Tim. You've given us a lot of great information, a lot of things to think about. And in the next part of this podcast, we're going to look at how some of these ideas filter into active managers' portfolio decisions. So that should be very interesting. Stay tuned.
That's it for this edition of The Investment Conversation. Please drop us a line on social media or visit our website at lordabbott.com. Our audio podcasts are available on iTunes, Spotify, TuneIn, and other major streaming media services. Thanks for listening. The Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index represents securities that are SEC registered, taxable, and dollar denominated. The index covers the U.S. investment grade fixed rate bond market, with index components for government and corporate securities, mortgage pass-through securities, and asset-backed securities. Duration is a measure of the sensitivity of the price, the value of principal, of a fixed income investment to a change in interest rates. The credit quality of the securities in a portfolio is assigned by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization, such as Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Fitch, as an indication of an issuer's creditworthiness. Ratings range from AAA, highest, to D, lowest. Bonds rated BBB or above are considered investment grade. Credit ratings BB and below are lower rated securities, junk bonds. High-yielding, non-investment-grade bonds, junk bonds, involve higher risks than investment-grade bonds. Adverse conditions may affect the issuer's ability to pay interest and principal on these securities. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. The value of investments in fixed-income securities will change as interest rates fluctuate and in response to market movements. Generally, when interest rates rise, the prices of debt securities fall, and when interest rates fall, prices generally rise. The municipal market can be affected by adverse tax, legislative, or political changes, and by the financial condition of the issuers of municipal securities. Investments in foreign or emerging market securities may be adversely affected by economic, political, or regulatory factors, and subject to currency volatility and greater liquidity risk. No investing strategy can overcome all market volatility or guarantee future results. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and are subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speaker are those of the speaker as of the date of the broadcast and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market or other conditions, and Lord Abbott disclaims any responsibility to update such views. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice. It is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to adopt any investment strategy. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. The information provided is not directed at any investor or category of investors and is provided solely as general information about Lord Abbott's products and services and to otherwise provide general investment education. None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in or refrain from any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbott nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity. If you are an individual retirement investor, contact your financial advisor or other fiduciary about whether any given investment idea, strategy, product, or service may be appropriate for your circumstances. This broadcast is the copyright 2019 of Lord Abbott & Company, LLC. All rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Lord Abbott Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbott Distributor, LLC.